Barnsley here, mate. Congratulations on keeping the Code AFL show going. I was a little bit worried when I left Italy to cover the Winter Paralympics that you wouldn't be able to keep the show on the road. And I am not surprised it takes two Chiefs to replace me, but I'm glad you're still trucking on. And I'm sure the episode will be held together by you with all that star power of Dan Cherney and Jay Clark. I'm just a little bit nervous about your authority with them, given they are a double chief show. So good luck. I'm looking forward to listening.
Great to hear from Josh Barnes there covering the Winter Paralympics in Italy. That was a non-consensual audio message played to open the Code AFL show, where I'm joined by News Corp's chief AFL writer, Jay Clark, and the chief cricket writer, Dan Cherney.
Hello, Ed. I'm disappointed there wasn't more swearing and what he really thinks, to be honest, about us, his honest thoughts, a bit like what Doherty said about Vossi. Just on that quickly, Sam Doherty is not a massive fan of Michael Voss, is he? Was that part crystal clear in the voice message or not, Dan?
I think that's become abundantly clear.
Yes.
I think in hindsight, some of that was probably quite clear last year. I think we start to put a piece through just some of the way the year panned out and some of the commentary around Doherty's role in the team and the phasing out of him. And look, don't get me wrong, Michael Voss says all the right things, but you just sort of think in hindsight, yeah, what were some of the messages coming out of the club suggesting that not all was right?
No, not at all.
I do feel for him for the way it's panned out this week. Hopefully he'll be back in the fold at Carlton. He will be by the Good Friday Super Clash, we know, in 5 or 6 weeks' time. So it's strange that they cut him from that speaking function.
So as Doherty said to Gorringe, mate, what on earth were you thinking?
You assume so.
They had the tough conversation around that.
I don't know. He was pretty gentle to him when I rang him for that story. When the audio first emerged on the podcast, he didn't want to kind of sink the boot into his mate and say, I've been stitched up here. But he did say, I didn't intend for it to go to air as it was. I'm not sure if Josh was actually across the story. I think it might have all unfolded during. He had about 36 hours of travel to Italy. And when our producer sent him the voice memo brief, I'm not sure if he knew what he was parroting. So he's just sent he's just done his own thing there. I think there would have been a few swear words if you knew what he was, if you knew what the assignment was. Big news broke overnight that Hawthorn might have been sitting on a big story out of the US. They had a training camp there to Arizona in November, and Dylan Moore and Connor McDonald got themselves into trouble, spent a night in a jail cell, Jay.
Yep. Well, I mean, and they should have been upfront about it as a footy club. Let's be honest, there's no secrets in football ever, really. So I think in this modern age where, so much social media, et cetera, on day two or day three of getting back, they should have been open about this. I mean, Dylan Moore, he's one of the most respected people and players at the club, clearly. It's cost him his vice captaincy. That's a very significant outcome, and he clearly feels incredibly embarrassed by the whole thing. So if you're going to put your hand up like that, I just think the club's mishandled it to some degree, in the sense that they should have been more up front about it early. And potentially there were some mitigating circumstances around that regards to the legal fallout or complications. So maybe we need to know more about that side of things. But potentially we could have heard about this a little bit earlier. I personally have never climbed a scissor lift. I'm unsure about the risks attached, but it seems like a pretty foolish mistake, which has cost him a very senior leadership position.
I've been up there once for work purposes in a form of casual employment. I was wearing a hard hat.
And had you had 15 beers beforehand, probably like the Hawks.
That's not the case. We do know, so Sam Mitchell will speak today on Wednesday, and we'll find out more information about when Hawthorn knew this. But they announced their leadership group changes in the middle of January. January 22, they confirmed that Newcombe had been elevated to co-captain. Dylan Moore had been left out because there was a three-man leadership group. Him and Luke Bruce were the vice captains to Sicily. So they knew from at least mid-January.
Yep.
It might emerge that they've known earlier. Dan, we saw during the Ashes that England sat on the Harry Brooks scandal. Obviously an offence of a different nature, but they sat on that one until the end of the series. The news came out, and then you'd probably argue that the backlash was bigger than it would have been if it had come out on the eve of the Ashes.
For sure. I mean, it's the old saying, the cover-up is always worse than the crime. And not always, but generally worse than the crime. And I think in the instance of Brooke and England, it's not sorry to make it all about cricket, but there was even subsequently it emerged that they had withheld certain parts of the information about which teammates were there, including Jacob Bethel. I think it was Josh Tung as well. For me, with Hawthorn here, to bring it back to the footy scenario, the thing that I'm, as a member of the media, I'm generally pro open information and the like. And for me, particularly for Hawthorn, a club that under Sam Mitchell has tried to reinvent itself as a much more open club. You know, they had that documentary on Channel 7 before the start of last season. They were the first ones to dive into that. The Saints have subsequently done similar.
Full sweat.
The whole Hockball evolution, you know, the selfies, all that sort of stuff. This is a club that has tried to, you know, portray an image of being open and progressive and, you know, moving on from the whole Clarko closed shop era. And, you know, that can't be conditional. You've got to be, if you want to be an open club, you've got to be open in all circumstances. And this is actually the time when it's most important to be up front. And I'm a genuine believer. Had they gone out and said this, you know, when it happened in whatever it was, in October, November, it would have been done by, I'm not saying we wouldn't have still be talking about it, but you certainly be talking about a lot less than you would be 2 days out from their first game, or the big Friday night game of the season, round one, and they're already 0-1.
Timing's horrendous. It's a great point, Daniel, but just as a side note, like, what have you covered up in your life? Is there anything you'd like to get off your chest, which you'd sort of anything you've done which feel like this isn't appropriate for them? Because in my bedroom once when I was about 15, I put a hole in my wall sort of trying to catch a tennis ball off my bed, and then I covered it up with a Muhammad Ali poster, and my parents didn't find out for at least a couple of years. So just as a side note, I felt like, you know, that I need to get that off my chest.
Did you have to? So you've addressed it now, but you probably didn't have to address it at the time to the public after it emerged.
I tried my absolute best to cover. I did cover it up, like, literally, with a big Muhammad Ali picture.
Yeah. So I think Hawthorn's punished Dylan Moore twice here by making him do that interview so long after the case. And
yep.
It was almost comical how serious he was about it, given what was reported in the end, the substance of it. But an interesting one.
I also just want to touch on that Channel 7 interview. And I get where Dylan Moore's coming from and trying to portray himself. And he has been a very respected, I think still is a respected member of that Hawthorn team. And I'd be surprised actually if he doesn't return to a leadership position at some stage in the future. He's still in his mid-20s. I'm not a big fan of this infantilization of Connor McDonald, who's 23. Like, Dylan Moore's 26.
Yep.
Well, like, what are we doing here? Like, I'm a senior player. Yes, you should know better. But what, you think Connor McDonald should know better because he's 23? I mean, come on.
Yep.
Ridiculous.
Yep.
No, fully agree with you on that. We've got a new one-off segment to introduce to the podcast. It's called Crystal Ball Regrets.
Ooh.
Now, we had to fire Crystal Balls Jay at the end of January.
Yep.
We've had the pre-season games, and we've now had 10 teams play in opening round. Is there anything that's keeping you up at night? Anything that you wish wasn't put to print in our season guide?
No, It's only early. But I didn't think Collingwood was a finals team. And as Scotty Pendlebury was leading a merry dance on the half forward flank in the second and third terms, I did have a sharp pang of crystal ball regret, because he was brilliant, and the Pies knocked over the Saints. I tipped St Kilda, and despite their 20 extra inside 50s, still the polish is a big question. Can they be clean going inside 50? Would have been so disappointed with Matthias Philippou and Sammy Flanders to, you know, some of their ball usage. Darcy Wilson had a big opportunity to really put a flag in the ground. But the Pies, led by Nick Dacos, 41 touches, were outstanding. So I thought they were going to fall over that cliff this year. I thought this would be the year. But old man Pendlebury, age 79, just did what he wanted, really. So I'm a little bit worried that I've underestimated the Pies.
I guess the one thing is they looked like they'd fallen off the cliff in opening round last year, and then by the following week they had it all together. So sometimes we can get a misleading view of Collingwood in the early stage of the season. But I had them 11th, and they looked so well-drilled, well-oiled. The forward structure really seemed to work.
Yep.
I'm a bit concerned.
That said, if Sharman nails his set shot, I think third term or fourth term, and then Wilson as well looks so jittery, you know, then St Kilda would have won that game, you'd think. So some execution really let them down. So I'm not totally losing faith in the Saints, because if they can clean some of that up, you know, I think they could have taken the 4 points. But there was signs of life in Collingwood. You know, Geordie DeGoey, you know, I was really impressed by. You know, without Darcy Moore and Jeremy Howe, we thought that back line might have been really vulnerable, but it stood up okay. But that St Kilda, that polish, that class is still very a relevant issue for them.
We'll touch back on St Kilda later on, but Dan, I'm not sure if we asked for a crystal ball from you, but I'm sure you would have come up with one internally and holding yourself accountable here. What has disappointed you so far?
It's important. Well, I'm going to come clean. No, look, the one that I think I may have got slightly wrong, you know, in my own mind was the Giants. I tipped Hawthorn. I mean, I think like a lot of people, we saw the list of the outs with the Giants and it was reaching sort of a tipping point, but they were very, very impressive.
Yep.
Now, I mean, whether Jake Stringer's going to continue to do that all year, I mean, as we know, it is a contract year for him. Mm-hmm. And we know he does lift in his contract years historically. But I think just the depth through that side, I mean, Jaden Laverde stood up quite well in his first game for the club. Joe Fonte, I think there's just some depth there, some of these role players at the Giants that we don't necessarily give credit to. And they... They're a funny club, the Giants, but I think over the course of their history, they've been a very good backs against the wall side.
Yep.
And not necessarily a great front-running team. I think they're the kind of team that actually play better when they are sort of the underdogs and there is a bit of us against them and they do get doubted, which is funny because they're not obviously not a big club per se and don't necessarily have a hell of a lot of supporters on their back. You know, they don't feel the pressure like a Carlton feel the pressure.
Yep.
Look, only one game in, but very impressed by the Giants first up.
Clayton Oliver looked like 2021. Clayton Oliver, so clean below his knees. And Finn Callahan's the one who has flown under the radar. He looked like Chris Judd. You know, two hands on the ball, you know, that Juddy style, twisting and turning out of traffic, that burst speed. I think I had him 31 in the top 50. Speaking of crystal ball regret, I was looking at him thinking he could be a top 15 player. Hmm. And then Ed Richards goes bananas later than Saturday night. I'm thinking he should be inside the top 10. So, I thought Callahan was incredible. And to think they've done it all, as you say, without Sammy Taylor, Brent Daniels, et cetera. There's a long list of them. Stephen Keneally had more than 23 high-speed meters. I'd say would have been good for the his confidence levels following the Adam Kingsley spray last year. So,
what's a good number of high-speed meters?
Well, in my instance, it's about 8. I think a lot of those guys are posting three-figure numbers, not 23 to halftime.
Right.
In that case, but yeah, you're right. I mean, they were really impressive, the Giants.
Yeah, I was particularly impressed with Callahan, given he'd had that hip flexor interruption over the preseason. It sounded like he was in doubt for opening round, but once we saw him out there, he was motoring away. He looked like the best midfielder on the ground for parts of that match.
Yep.
My crystal ball regret, Geelong, had them top four. Thought they're probably ready to be the first club in a while to put a heavy grand final loss behind them, buck that trend.
Yep.
I think it's going to be hard to finish top four if they look a bit undercooked. I reckon it might take a couple of weeks to turn around. What was your assessment of that one? Can they bridge that gap quickly? They did not look ready for the heat that Gold Coast brought.
Yeah, I sort of had them about fourth or fifth from memory. It's a tough start to the season. Mm. Like, I reckon I'll tip Fremantle probably to beat them at home, or I'm certainly leaning that way at the moment. They've had some, you know, it's another short preseason for them. I think the discussion around Chris Scott is really interesting. Clearly, he's given the keys to James Kelly and Nathan Buckley to a degree. Gold Coast were incredible. They just had no answers for Petrarca and the Suns' pressure. They're so hungry. And on the road, they're going to be so hard to beat. So I think you give the Cats an out. But, gee, it's going to be interesting to see how they respond at home, where they've won probably 80, 90% of their matches over the last 20 years. So it's not break glass in case of emergency yet. But if the Dockers, who are such a quality outfit themselves, can notch victory, I think that the spotlight and the blowtorch goes up a little bit. But this is a club that's been at the top for 20 years. It's hard. it's hard to fault them. But maybe after such a tough start to the season, they might be playing a bit of catch up this year.
Ed, Dan and Jay will be right back. But now let's head to a stats check-in with Champion Data.
We've been lucky enough to have Champion Data's Corey Mobilio wander down South Bank to join us in the studio. And Corey, how did you find opening round? Did you think that the new rules had a tangible effect on the game?
Yeah, obviously we're working with a small sample size, but I think, you know, four of the first five games were really good from a scoring explosion point of view. So looking at that, the opening round as a whole, so 97.3 points per game, per team, which was the highest average score in a home and away round since 2017. So you look at just some basic measures in terms of, you know, how sides move the ball, their efficiency going inside 50, scoring from centre bounces were all up on last year, and also stoppages were down. So I think if those trends continue, we'll be in for a pretty exciting year of footy.
Do you think it's more the rules, or is it possible that patchy defences first round of the season have caused some of this? Were there any defensive indicators that were really just way under what usual benchmarks are?
Yeah, look, you look at round zero, and obviously you're trying to build a sample size of data, but I think it's more how teams are trying to play with their aggression. And we saw some really good examples on Thursday night with Sydney and Gold Coast with their aggression and their ability to take that ball through the corridor. So, I do think the rules had a bit of an effect on that. But, I guess time will tell with once we build a bit more sample size.
It's been covered to death this week, but one of the biggest stories has been the leaked Sam Doherty voice message about Carlton's his frustrations basically with Carlton's one-dimensional game plan, saying if their inside midfielders are beaten, the Blues don't have an answer. Now, the Blues have been adamant that they're not losing games in the same way, as Doherty put. Michael Voss said yesterday that there is a new Carlton, there's a new way that they're trying to play, and they saw glimpses of it on Thursday night against the Swans. Did you see anything that suggests they are trying to play in a different way this season?
Yeah, I think that forward surge handball was something that we haven't seen under a Voss side since he basically took over. So they recorded 528 metres gained from handball, which was the most under Voss. And you look at the previous 4 years, they're actually the fourth lowest side in the competition for that measure. In terms of how they play, yeah, a different looking Carlton side. But I think where the angst comes is where the execution and the transition game and all those factors. So method looked different, but a bit of the same old with their efficiency and transition.
So it was there until half time, and then they just came out and forgot to play that way.
Yeah, it was a funny old game, and you might touch on someone like Walsh, where that first half really suited how Carlton were trying to play, and he was the number one ranked player on the ground at half time, and it was the first time in his career that he went over 15 disposals, 350 metres gained, 5 inside 50s and 4 score involvements in a half. And you look at the second half, he dropped to the 34 rated player on the ground.
Wow.
If you look at Walsh, if he finishes a game as a top 5 rated player on the ground, Carlton are over a 70% chance of winning. In terms of how they want to play in that forward surge and those power runners, looking at Walsh, I think he's arguably Carlton's most important player. And we saw that on Thursday night where when the second half went probably the wrong way, his impact really dried up. And someone like Jagger as well was quite instrumental in that first half also.
I remember talking early last season about how important Walsh was to Carlton as well. I think there were numbers of his score involvements and how it correlated into wins for Carlton. So clearly, take him out, you're a big chance of beating the Blues. Any other players that popped out at you in opening round that really stood out?
Yeah, Ed Richards was one, and I think there's a bit of a flow-on effect. So we had him as the number 3 rated player in the competition last year. And you look at his game from opening round, so it was the 7th best performance by a Bulldogs player from their ball use on record. And he was also just the 10th player across the last 10 years to go over 30 disposals, 700 metres gained and 15 score involvements. It's probably the flow-on effect for me. Like, one, he probably needs to be spoken about as one of the premier mids in the competition now, but it's also allowing Bontempelli to roll forward. So I just had a look before I came in here. When Bont is a forward 50 target, just looking at the start of last year, so he's been a target 25 times. The Dogs have scored a goal 50% of the time he's been targeted inside 50. So the flow-on effect with Richards and announcing himself as a premier mid in the competition is allowing Bontempelli to go forward. He'll draw an awkward matchup, and the Dogs, that forward dynamic, again, changes complexion when he's down there.
I'm not sure if you got the numbers, but I think they're both quite accurate shots at goal as well, or at least were last season. Has that been a factor that Bontempelli and Richards are so good at finishing off their work?
Yeah, and that also, but one, their ability to win clearance forward of centre, that post-clearance ball, is really important in this day and age, and there's probably no better player in the competition than, Bontempelli's going to make you quite nervous standing at full forward on him. So I think that's a different element, as well as Richard's ground ball game and his ball use that really sets him apart.
And Sunday night, Collingwood surprised us a bit against St Kilda, and Scott Pendlebury obviously caught the eye at half forward with his career high 5-goal assist, but I think there was another forward that caught your eye.
Yeah, obviously probably not spoken about in the same vein as of being managed to like a Pendlebury, but so Jordan Dugowie only 81 minutes time on ground, so it was just a tick under 70% game time, and it was a 30-70 mid-forward split. Looking at him, he had his 7th most impact from ball use over his last 5 years. Just the fourth time in his career, he went over 15 disposals, 400 metres gained, and 3 goals. So I think that ageing veteran list of Collingwood, injuries do build up, but I think managing these players and giving De Goey and Pendlebury a short spell, whether that be over a couple rounds or in game, they're going to be not only critical to the wins and loss column, but their finals chances.
Just before we let you go, Corey, the Hawks were pretty disappointing against GWS last week. Is there anything that's jumped out at you ahead of this clash against Essendon on Friday night?
Yeah, I think the one thing that should be on the Bombers' whiteboard is that how gettable Hawthorn have been at a defensive 50 stoppage since the start of last year. So looking since the start of last year, Hawthorn conceded 68 scoring shots from a defensive 50 stoppage, which sat them 16th in the competition. Yes. They got bailed out a bit by opposition inaccuracy. And look at the game against GWS on the weekend. Again, they conceded another 4 scoring shots from that part of the ground. So I think, whether it be personnel or system, it's an area that the Bombers could look to exploit on Friday night.
Is there anything going in the Hawks' favour in terms of having played the week before? What have we seen now over these opening round into round one transitions when a team comes in against a fresh team that hasn't played yet?
Yeah, a bit of a quirky one kind of looking at it today. So there's only been 6 games across opening round since the start of 2 years ago. So the 6 winners have gone on to win in round one. So they're 6-0, the opening round winners the following week in round one. So not sure how that doesn't obviously read too well for Hawthorn. But yeah, just something quirky.
Oh, there you go, tipsters. Looks like you're pretty safe going with the opening round winners this week. Well, thanks for coming in, Corey. Really appreciate your time, and hopefully we'll be able to get you on throughout the season with Champion Data. But thanks very much for adding a bit of concrete evidence to our podcast.
Thank you.
Now it's back to Ed, Dan and Jay.
There's been a few non-typical pre-game traditions that clubs have introduced in recent seasons. And opening round, we had a look at St Kilda's new thing, the knock-knock. Now, Dan, can you give us your fan perspective on how that went? Nick Revolt was involved in it. I caught some of it up in the media box, but was caught out a bit by the timing of it. What do you think? Did it set the right tone for the start of the game?
Look, I think if you step back and say, look, 82,000 people at the game, and obviously a huge support from Collingwood for Collingwood as always. But I think leaving the result to one side and St Kilda were competitive, it was a broadly successful night for the St Kilda Football Club as a collective. In terms of that particular moment, I don't have hugely strong feelings about it. I think it was, look, the knock-knock has sort of grown as a bit of a, knock-knock, who's there, oh, and no one who, just for those wanting, don't quite get it. I didn't hate it. I'm not a massive sort of match day experience guy generally. I don't love all that.
You don't love being told to make some noise?
Make some noise.
You could go.
No, yeah. I thought, having said that, I think that one sort of makes a degree of sense. Like they're sort of leaning into something that's already part of the culture. It's not as though they're sort of trying to create something out of nothing. I think Essendon, I've seen, are going to ramp up the jacket waving. Again, it's based in something that's already organic, and you're just sort of trying to sort of augment it, I suppose, amplify it. The Saints lent into the goal songs for players. Now, if you're going to have music between goals, I prefer you have the player ones, the individual player ones, but I'm going to die on this hill. Music between goals is bad. Bad for football.
What about Charlie Cameron?
Bad for football.
You don't like Country Road?
No.
You're the only person in Australia who thinks Country Road's a bad thing.
Oh, the song's fine, but I don't like, I'm not a big fan. I think we lose a lot. Now, I get it probably works in Brisbane and they tapped into the moment there. And don't get me wrong, I know the Lions fans love it, so I'm not asking Lions fans to agree with me here, but I think as a collective, we lose the natural sounds of the game, the build-up, the gradual rise and then the gradual decrease and the hum of between goals, particularly in a big game, a big grand final. Like, I'm trying to think back. Was it Charlie Cameron kicked one late in the 23 grand final?
His song, Country Road, played just before the start of the second quarter, I think, Jay, and then Charlie went on a heater, kicked a couple of goals in 5 minutes, and Eddie McGuire was very cranky that they played his song before he got on a roll. But I don't think there were goal songs in that grand final.
I know this is very, maybe the last couple. I know this is very old man media of me. to borrow a line from for my son's great.
Yeah.
But, I'm not a general fan of that.
I interviewed Dan Gorringe. This is my Dan Gorringe story for his draft. that year. I did something like 30 interviews.
And great series, that, actually.
Thank you, Daniel. That was by far the most boring I've ever...
He didn't call you a Muppet rat?
He sat there. It was the most flat and disinteresting interview I've ever had in my entire life. Now, I quite enjoy what Daniel does, but I'm like, where was the personality back then, Dan? Because my interview was crap because it was such a one-dimensional interview. So he's come to life since then, and I enjoy a lot of his gags. But he played a straight bat to me back in the day. Smart man.
He would have been extremely nervous in the presence of Jay Clark, I imagine.
He would have been. Tommy Liberatore also didn't give me much that year from memory. Anyway, I digress. The thing on the crowd... with the crowd fan engagement, I think there's a big gap between the best and worst. I love Port Adelaide's Never Tear Us Apart. I love the Charlie Cameron thing. So you got to know your fan base. You got to know what's worked for them. So I think the research, like at Geelong, is typically a really quieter crowd, right? So maybe it doesn't fly as well for them. And you need it to be sort of in taste and what your fan wants. So I think the club's doing the research with their own fan base about what they want is important in the whole thing.
Look, I think the other thing is we are not the target market. We're going to go to the footy regardless.
Yep.
You know, we're heavily invested.
Yeah.
And you've got to remember that they are trying to, target the next generation of people that aren't necessarily, you know, to kids and those who are sort of take a passing interest in the game and to try to bring them back. And some of those things are the types that lure people in, albeit I think the game is high quality enough that it should be able to stand on its own two feet.
I think Sydney do something distinctive. They've got a DJ playing for 2 hours before the game, which is, you know, I quite like that. It's quite up vibe and interesting. And then, the Sweet Caroline I think really works for them. You know, that's...
Just not enough Sweet Caroline at sporting events, I think, historically. Just chronically underplayed song.
What I do like is the Lions fans' commitment to seeing Country Road, even in one of the most high-octane, high-scoring games, like the one against the Bulldogs on Saturday night. They were still singing as the Bulldogs were kicking goals, like they hadn't finished their goal song yet, so they just stuck with it.
Yep. I wonder if they, and eventually things will turn for the Lions and say Charlie's still playing, and if they have a 12-goal defeat...
Yep.
And Charlie puts one through, you know, to narrow the margin to 75 points, the 26-minute mark at the final term, where the noise will quite be there.
As much enthusiasm.
Yeah.
No, they're in a pretty strong position at the moment.
No, they are.
How did that happen? Well, Dan, I did want to ask you before we go. I'm a cricket nuffy. I watch a lot of cricket. Is it bad that I had no idea who Cole McConchie was when he rolled out in the semi-final, took a couple of wickets, put South Africa on their backside?
It makes you a bad person. I'm glad you had mea culpa. No, he's one of the more obscure members of the New Zealand side, but he's come along nicely. And it was another case of so near but so far for the Black Caps, who continually punch above their weight but couldn't quite get it done against the might of India in the final.
Jay, question without notice, not about cricket.
Mm.
Who is the Cole McConchie of the AFL? Who is on a list at the moment that people haven't spend a lot of time thinking about who could have a big year?
Well, we were scrambling to get the right pronunciation of Zane Zakostelski last week. I wasn't quite across that. I won't get into the origins of my own surname, which started with Z for 10 years of my childhood. So I'm familiar.
Right, I think we've got a spin-off podcast here.
Maybe let's exclude that part. But
Jay-Z. Yes.
Zane Zakostelski, I think, was someone who we had to get across quite quickly. So he has the potential to become a real cult figure for the Brisbane Lions, I think.
Great to break some exclusive news on this podcast from Jay Zakostelski Clark.
It is a long, long story, that one.
We'll pull out a special at some point on that one. Thanks very much for joining us, guys. It's going to be a fantastic round one. You can follow all our coverage on the Herald Sun and Code Sports websites.